we're heading. I started off by telling you, the saving grace in Barbados has been an extraordinarily high level of social trust. And that is what, the reason we have been able to keep our currency pegged to the US dollar over the decades is because of this social trust. The reason why civil servants in the early 90s voted to, approved overwhelmingly taking an 8% cut is the social trust. So it is social trust that is people, it is love of Barbados that is keeping Barbados afloat. But at some stage, people are going to say, you know, there's a lot of nonsense. I can break for myself. And when that happens, the whole thing will collapse. Right. So everything is relative. I am saying we're in dire straits compared to what at different times in our history we have been.
I agree with you entirely, Dr. Laurie. Now, I have just seen a message come up on the computer screen here. Which says, Busy should know because he gives political contributions, political
campaign
finance contributions. What do you think, Dr. Laurie, about the doing away with private sector contributions to political re-election campaigns and so on, and have it funded by the Treasury so that there is no inclination on the private sector, and that ministers and people who are going to be involved in government do not have to go and beg people like me or anybody else for that matter for contributions in order to get reelected?
No, in principle, I would agree with that. I mean, I have not looked into this aspect of our system very closely, but I know people like, I think, Andrew Bynum and Patrick Frost and Andy Armstrong were looking at this thing very critically, and they have probably come up with some suggestions that may be along the lines you suggested, Busy. So I really don't know, but I mean, I think there is a danger of private sector contribution, both in fact and certainly in perception, as to what then a government will do.
I agree with you absolutely. The problem is that the government has to make a decision. The both political parties need to make the decision. This is and fund it from the Treasury. But until that is done, no single private sector entity is going to, they cannot change the system. Because if I don't do a little something, the next fellow will do a little something, and the next thing you will hear, we never get a contract again. I didn't come here to play goody goody. I come here to tell you the truth. That is how it is.
And yo, Sanka, I have to go on cook lunch, all
right? Dr. Laurie, thank you very much for participating. We'll take a break here, and just remember this special program today is brought to you with the kind compliments of Williams Industries Incorporated.
Now is the time for you to fence your property with galvanized green, white, or brown chain link fencing and our brown band galvanized pole pipes, which are the longest lasting. We will give you a free estimate too on all your fencing material.
For building supplies, big or small, at Williams Metals we have it all. At Williams Metals we have it all.
Visit their website at www.williamsmetals.bb.
Welcome back to Rastak Sunday. We've had some very good discussions so far, and we have on the line our third invitee, Mr. Shane Lowe. He's an economist, he's a 29-year-old, and he has a lot of concerns about young people and what is happening. Mr. Lowe, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Sanka. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, he's not putting on his earphones. You go right ahead. Your concerns?
Yeah, so I think certainly as a young person, one of the major issues that is plaguing Barbados is really the economy. And that's probably one of the areas that I am that I can speak to as well from my perspective as president of the Barbados Economic Society. Economic growth has been pretty weak over the last, I would say, 9 or so years. And as a result, unemployment is quite high. And unemployment in general is high, youth unemployment typically tends to be higher than the average. you have a lot of young persons out there, many of whom are going to school and leaving secondary school or the community college or the university, and looking for jobs, and they're not able to find those jobs. And that is a big concern, because it means that while we're starting to discuss the whole issue of, can we afford free education and can we afford certain social services, I think discussion should shift from can we afford it to are we getting the most out of the investment in these social services, and particularly education. So are we facilitating younger persons being able to set up their own businesses? And your previous caller spoke about the ease of doing business, and that's a big part of it. People being able to set up their own businesses, being able to access financing, especially since they probably don't have a long track record or any track record at all of running a business or maybe employment, that they can get financing from the traditional sources, which would be the banks and the credit unions, etc. And that is going to be related to some extent, the crime situation, because if people are employed, there's a lot lower chance of them getting up to deviant behavior. But I also want to speak about leveraging our investment in education from the perspective of the entire policymaking framework in Barbados. So we have a system where it appears to many persons that most decisions are made by 30 persons in Parliament. And many times we hear discussions outside of Parliament about whether persons agree or disagree with what has been presented, what has been discussed, the laws that have been passed. And I've always thought, well, how do we have a public sector that is better engaged with the population and the young people in particular, so that they can leverage the ideas that these persons have, particularly the new ideas that they will have from the new education that they're getting. So, for example, before we discuss the estimates of revenue and expenditure on an annual basis in Parliament, why don't we have something set up where the draft estimates are presented maybe at a parish level or a constituency level or whatever it may be, and an individual can provide their thoughts about the estimates. They can speak about whether they think enough is allocated to education or not. They can speak about whether they think the way that the deficit will be financed, whether it be from domestic or external sources, the implications of that for the country on the foreign exchange reserves. And they can provide their insights and their analysis, and then when the parliamentarian or whoever it is goes to the debate, he or she can provide this feedback, and Parliament can have a debate on that. So the point I'm trying to make is that young people want to have a voice, and many times they have very wonderful ideas, but they need to be engaged at a deeper level to ensure that you get the most out of them, and that we don't just see education as, you know, sending someone to university, they go get a job, and then they continue to work. We see it as a means of empowering our people so that they can advance Barbados, not just working in the organization, but also adding to the policy discussion and setting the policy agenda as well. I can also speak as well about the standard issues that we have in Barbados, if the foreign exchange reserves, the fiscal deficit, growth. These are going to require us as well to have discussions free of as much political bias as possible about agencies such as the IMF, about the need or the role of the state in providing certain social services. And I think we as a country now, not just young people, need to be less afraid about having these discussions and more honest and open about ourselves, or with ourselves, about what we need to do as a country and why we need to do these things. So those are a couple of things that I want to put on the table: leveraging our investments in education and ensuring that young persons and people in general can play a bigger role in the policy agenda, but also having more meaningful and honest discussions with ourselves about issues of social services, the IMF, other issues, some of which are practical, some of which are academic.
Are you suggesting too, Shane, that the country is in a precarious situation right now with our foreign reserve situation the way it is, and that we should be thinking about going to the IMF?
Yeah, so I think, to answer the first question, are we in a precarious position? I would say Yes, I think the last reported number was at December 2017. That was 6.6 weeks, or about $410 million of reserves. But the level to me is not so much important. It is the trajectory. And the trajectory is that we've lost reserves for each year since 2013. And so I remember a few weeks ago, Senator Ince, Jeffrey Ince, was on the program, and he was asking a question about whether 12 weeks is the right number or not. Now, there actually has been some research on that by some local economists that says that 25 weeks might be the better number to aim for. But regardless of whether it's 12 or 25, certainly hurtling towards a number like zero is, I think everyone can agree that that is not the right number to be at. And it means that in the short run, we're going to have to close that gap between foreign exchange inflows and outflows, and someone like the IMF might provide those funds at affordable rates. What the IMF also provides is it allows the country to be able to gain some additional credibility if the country can be seen to be meeting certain targets that the IMF program has associated with it. So, for example, if the program says the country needs to reduce its fiscal deficit to 2%, for example, by, say, December 2018, if that's the target, and the country can meet that, then the IMF says, okay, we'll give you a tick and we'll disperse some additional funds. And foreign investors look at that, and there's confidence that they gain from that, and they might be able to return both private and both for the private sector and public sector to provide the government and the private sector with funds to help to stimulate growth, to help to close the persistent gap in foreign exchange, etc. So the short answer is yes, I think the IMF is a viable source of assistance right now, particularly in the short term, simply because many of the other measures are going to be they're going to take a bit longer to materialize, and we don't have that plan right now, given the level of the reserves.
So you're not really keen on a homegrown plan?
Well, the plan can be and must be homegrown, but it must be financed somehow. So the plan can say we want to reduce our fiscal deficit by, we want to eliminate the fiscal deficit by next fiscal year, for example. But that doesn't necessarily put the credit rating back up to investment grade overnight. And what it doesn't do is it doesn't provide inflows to match the outflows we have to make to pay the Credit Suisse facility, for example, to pay the debt on the prison, and other debts that we're having to repay because we don't have enough inflows coming in to repay them. So the program can be homegrown, yes, but the financing and the backing of the IMF is important because it adds the foreign exchange inflows in the short term to stabilize the reserves. But then it also adds the credibility to say, well, you're able to achieve the targets under your own program. And so as an investor, I'm more confident to lend you money in the medium term.
Busy, what's your take on the whole situation with the foreign reserves? And are you seeing as well any slowing of foreign exchange coming into your different businesses?
Actually, the tourism industry has been very good this year. Many of the banks have foreign exchange. So I would not suggest for a second that our foreign reserves have turned the corner. But what I would ask is this. We are nearly the end of March. Do you think we should still be hearing about our foreign reserve position at the end of December? We should be up to date. We should be up with the computer systems that are available these days. We should know day by day what our foreign reserves are. So something is going wrong. Is somebody deliberately hiding the information, or we just lack the systems to monitor it? And I agree with the economists that we need a source of foreign exchange to pay off the high interest debts that we have incurred. And the IMF is probably the best source of cheap foreign exchange. And so we have to engage with them and negotiate efficiently for the best deal possible. That is my opinion. And it will give foreign investors more confidence if they believe that we are in a program that it is being responsibly managed. So I have not met this gentleman, but I certainly am very impressed with his views, and I agree with almost everything that he has said.
The question I'm going to pose to both of you, the government recently broke off negotiations with the unions for the public sector pay raises. But what was also interesting is that they took the $45 million offer that they made to public servants off the table as well. Now, politics apart, could it be that the economy is worsening, that this $45 million was taken off the table? Your thoughts?
I really have no idea. Thank you. Don't want me to express an opinion on something that I don't know anything about.
I'm just throwing it out there. Shane, what about you? What is your thought on actually removing that? Because remember, the government made that one-off offer, but then removed it.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't want to speculate on the rationale for why the government did that. What I can say, though, is that ultimately, because the fiscal deficit and the size of it is linked to the foreign exchange, it's linked to the credit rating, sorry, and the credit rating is linked to our ability to borrow, and that's really part of why we're having to repay debt without being able to replace it. Anything that puts additional pressure on the fiscal deficit needs to be financed in some way, either through higher taxes or cuts to other expenditures. So there always has to be a balancing act there with respect to how the government is going to afford to pay additional wages and salaries. There's also the implication that additional wages and salaries is going to create more demand in the economy, and that is going to help with growth in the short term, but it also helps to accelerate potentially the increase in imports, which also can have an impact on the foreign exchange levels. So I think those are the major considerations that any government is going to have to take into consideration when it's trying to decide how much and if it's going to grant wage increases.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, one of the elephants in the room here is that we're talking reform of the public sector. And when people say that, we're talking about reducing the size of the public service. So let's deal with that. Is that possible at this stage? Dr. Laurie is suggesting that it needs to be done, and it can be done over 5 years. Former Governor Dr. Ward is suggesting it be done over 3 years, with $1,500 a year leaving the public service. So what do you think?
Right. Well, I think, as with other things, I try not to think of it in terms of just simply the size of the public sector. Any business or any government, anyone that's creating a product or a service, there are two main things that they need. They need labor and they need capital. And labor needs capital and technology and infrastructure to be as productive as possible. And you will employ as much labor as you can if the labor is being more productive than the cost of the actual labor. So I say all that to say this. If the labor is not being as productive, then you either have to consider cutting the labor, or you have to consider improving the systems and the capital available to that labor to be as productive as possible. And that capital will require money to invest in the technology and the capital, etc. But whatever public sector reform need not just look at the number of people employed, but whether those persons are being as productive as they can. Because if we had 50,000 people employed in the public sector, for example, and they were able to provide a level of service that enabled the country to earn enough foreign exchange and generate enough taxes that could pay for their salaries times over, then that would not be a problem. But if the systems that are in place are not allowing them to do that, then you need to either increase the capital or reduce the size of the public sector to a point where it is becoming as efficient as possible and you can afford to operate it using the inflows of taxes you get to cover those persons' wages and salaries, and any other social services that you're providing to the country.
In other words, what you're suggesting is that every man jack has to earn its own keep.
Well, basically in those terms, yeah.
Yeah, and that the government's objective, or should be the government's objective, is to provide the systems and the equipment and so on that enables public servants to be very efficient and to earn their own keep many times over.
Yes, and the key point is that productivity is not, we think about productivity in terms of just people, but productivity is also with respect to the systems and capital you have in place. So I don't like to just look at it as people being inefficient, but it's maybe people being inefficient with the systems that are in place, because output is determined by capital, labor, and technology.
All right. Shane, thank you so very much for being here, and I hope everyone is listening, because, as I said, this special program today is to get everybody to start thinking in terms of what are some of the major problems that we have, major challenges that we have in Barbados. And we're not only raising these things, but we're also focusing in how they can be fixed. So thank you very much, Shane.
Thank you as well.
And we've now been joined by Dr. Conor Lert. He's a family physician and lecturer at the University of the West Indies. Dr. Lert, good is afternoon. Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good afternoon. Not too bad. How are you?
I'm well. And I'd like you to share your concerns with what's happening in Barbados, and how do you think that we can go about to fix it?
Well, thanks for inviting me, first of all. We have a lot of challenges in health. Primarily, you know, what I think we would like to do is focus a little more on health promotion and disease prevention. A majority of our illnesses are the chronic diseases, you know, diseases such like diabetes, hypertension, and their complications, heart attacks, strokes, and so on. And these are diseases which are very much preventable, so that we need to focus on prevention. You know, they're preventable, but in truth and in fact, we don't have any programs in place for preventing them. In terms of how they develop, or what is a big relationship to these diseases, obesity is a big problem. And we have data that suggests obesity exists in our primary schools, in our secondary schools, and so on. And once you become overweight or obese, then the diseases that are related to them are diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol. And then when you develop those, you're at risk for heart attacks, strokes, and death. So we have a scenario where we have way too many of our people being overweight and obese, then developing the subsequent problems, and then, you know, getting very sick, getting ill and dying. We're at a point where, see, there's a massive overload at our Queen Elizabeth Hospital from these diseases, and it's causing major, major costs. So apart from it costing the country a tremendous amount of money, and we know that every year for the last few years, you know, the Ministry of Health has had to cut back its allocation to health. So it's very costly, yet still people are losing their vision, people are losing their limbs, people are having heart attacks, people are having strokes, people are dying. So, you know, the amount of suffering, the amount of costs are tremendous. And if we can, in fact, focus a lot more on disease prevention, on treating disease at a primary care level in the polyclinics, then, you know, we can lower the workload on the hospital. We can lower the amount of suffering and death that we're currently having. But unfortunately, you know, certainly at a national level, we don't have any programs that are focused in this direction. We have, as far back as 1980, comments from Dr. Frank Ramsey, who was our principal nutrition officer, and he looked at national nutrition surveys of 1969 and 1980. And his comment way back in 1980 was that we need to look at obesity as a matter of urgency. So that's a comment that came about 38 years ago, talking about the necessity for looking at obesity urgently. And that exists today. So over 38 years, you know, we haven't actually done anything towards looking at obesity and its prevention. And that, you know, over the years has led to the problem we are in today. And in fact, it's actually getting worse.
So what can really be done? I mean, we know we have this major problem. It's talked about all the time. You mentioned it. This last, what, 30-odd years. What can actually be done about this problem?
Right. Well, obesity has two simple major components: eating too much and not getting enough exercise. So, you know, from one point of view, as a country, we're lazy and we're licorice. Okay? So that's what we need to do. We need to promote physical activity a lot more. And we all know that our kids, for example, now, you know, play games with their fingers. They're on their laptops, they're on their smartphones and so on. They don't get out and run and jump and sweat as we do. Okay? And then they eat too much, whether it's the fast foods, whether it's the soft drinks, or, you know, much of other issues. But we eat too much and we drink too much. And unless we promote in a major way healthy eating to our youth, we have, you know, we'll end up and continue to have problems that we do today. You know, primary school surveys have suggested like about 1/3 of primary school children are already overweight, and another 15% are obese. So we have problems at our primary school level, and it only gets worse as the years go on.
One of my concerns is that, okay, we all recognize we have this problem. But at the same time we recognize we have this problem, what programs are actually being put in place at a national level within not only the school system to deal with the school children, but I mean nationally, where are the parks? Where are the where are the green spaces? What is being done to ensure that Barbadians would be able to exercise, to be able to at least get some exercise? You know, where is that being done?
Yeah, right. That's a good question. And first of all, I don't think there's any national attempt to do any of this, okay? We have lots of open spaces. We have beaches. We have tourists who pay thousands of pounds and come in here and say, oh, the beach is marvelous. It's lovely. And us beaches, the boy, the CNO back door, I go in there and the sun too hot, you know. So our foreigners come and find lots of spaces to walk and exercise. And we here say, nah, boy, I go in there. You know, it's too dangerous, or somebody gets shoot, or some rasta man just smoke weed wrong day, so I'm walking. So, you know, some of it is true, obviously, you know, and we need to put a little more effort in some of the safety and potholes and people driving and so on. But still, we find way too many excuses not to get out and exercise. Similarly, in terms of eating, you know, we just sort of become fast food junkies, you know, we have tons of fast food outlets, you know, basically at every other corner. So we eat too much, we drink too much soft drinks, you know. And there's no official effort to sort of change habits. You know, maybe some individual schools do it, you know, for their kids. But still, at a national level, I'm not aware that we're actually tackling this.
If you were the Minister of Health or a leading person in government, what would you do to tackle this situation?
Yeah, we need a lot more focus on preventive medicine. You know, right now what we currently have is a lot of focus on Queen Elizabeth Hospital and funding it. And basically we're saying people, when they get sick, you know, we're gonna patch you up. You know, we have hospital there. And we all know the hospital is massively overcrowded and underfunded. Okay. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we need to focus or shift our resources a lot more to primary care, to the polyclinics, which are all understaffed and, you know, overcrowded. But we're trying to focus more on preventing disease rather than waiting for disease to set in and then patch it. So we need to shift our focus away from the hospital and towards primary care, where we have a much better effort at preventing disease or treating it in the early stages before it develops the problems.
And a part of that primary care would be like also some campaigns trying to educate people about what they're eating, how to prepare the different foods, that type of thing.
Very much so. And sustained efforts starting on our kids. You know, I think a couple of our generations are lost, you know. But, you know, we need to get for the young people to do it.
Mm-hmm. All right. But so what are some of the other concerns? Because we were talking about the actual Ministry of Health. They have not given us a report for quite a few years, Chief.
Yeah. The last annual Chief Medical Officer's report covered the year 2009. So since then to now, you know, we haven't had an annual report from the Chief Medical Officer.
Well, why is this important? I mean, does it really matter?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I would think it's important for us to get an idea of what's happening in the trend of our health, okay? Mm-hmm. We do have a couple other important data sources, the National Cancer Registry, the National Chronic Disease Registry, and we have a big study done by both the Ministry of Health and the Chronic Disease Research Center in 2015 called the Health of the Nation Study. And incidentally, the report of that study actually used the same word that Sir Frank Ramsey used in 1980, saying we need to do something urgently about our health. So, you know, we have these official reports, people do studies, they get data, and they all say we need to do something urgently, and then after that, nothing is done, right? But yes, we have other data sources, but yes, it would be nice to know what has happened, you know, sequentially, especially since a lot of this kind of overlaps the period where economically we've been challenged. Mm-hmm. You know, and we can either look at it and then study it and kind of work out plans to how can we prevent and go further in the future.
Well, what I get from what you're really saying is that if we have some idea of what is happening, we can plan more effectively.
But we can plan more effectively, but you know, we do have data right now, lots of it, that we're not using, and you know, we need to do that as well.
Mm-hmm. So what is the answer?
Yeah. Well, again, I'm biased, but I'd like to see a much greater focus on preventive medicine, you know, trying to prevent people from getting sick. You know, an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. An ounce of prevention is a lot cheaper than a pound of cure. Right, so that, you know, right. I mean, our health budget, you know, 2016-2017 was $450 million. That's massive amount of money, okay? Mm-hmm. But a lot of that, again, goes towards the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. We need to refocus that towards primary care and preventing people from getting sick.
All right. We'll take a couple of calls before we go to the 12:30 news. Good afternoon. You're on Brass Tack Sunday.
Hello, good afternoon.
Yes, thank you so much for holding.
Yes, is this Mr. Sanka?
Yes, Ken? You're on the air, sir.
Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon.
I actually came on this program as a layman to bring in certain subjects, but the conversation so far has been so very interesting. I don't want to waste time in any preamble. Let me get right to it. First, I have a little problem with people who say they do not care who wins the election. I don't really think they understand how important it is. You have to care who wins the election because you look at the track record and you look at the promises that they have been made and then you come to the decision. Otherwise, you cannot consider yourself a citizen who is interested in the country. So we should all care who wins the election, whoever it is or whichever group it is. The second thing I heard Sister Chandler with a shopping list, which was going quite good, but one thing I did not hear, I may be wrong, but I didn't hear anything about the Westminster practice where any member of parliament who is going abroad or whatever has to report to the constituents of the parliament where they're going and so on. I think that is a very useful thing because some of these our politicians have been accused of going on joy rides and bringing back nothing in return. And some of those things can cost a lot of money, especially when you're traveling first class and so on. That's one thing. My other problem, though, I think the biggest one of all is the fact that we have a constitutional crisis in Barbados right now that transcends the economic problems that we're having.
What constitutional crisis is that?
Now, I will ask you a question too, because sometimes it's always good to answer a question by another question before we move on. What do you understand by the dissolution of Parliament?
Parliament is no more for the time being.
Therefore, you should have no leader, with all due respect, of the opposition, and no president of the Senate, because there's no Parliament. I know that the Constitution says that is the supreme law of Barbados, but it's not supreme, because in that constitution, it says, let me see what I got here, the people of Barbados proclaim that they are a sovereign nation founded on the principles that acknowledge, this is the important part, the supremacy of God, the dignity of the human person, and the unshakable faith in fundamental human rights. Now, we have a situation where a group of people mentioned in the acknowledged in the Constitution are allowed to continue to receive emoluments for holding posts that do not really exist, in my opinion. I did raise that issue about the supremacy deliberately, because we must always remember that it's not only the law that we should acknowledge. And therefore, it is my contention that there should be nothing called a leader of an opposition, since there's no parliament, and there should be nothing of the president of the Senate. And then all of this money, when we are hard pressed, there are people I saw in this morning's paper who are saying that they're not going to work for $10 picking, Cowich. Mm-hmm. And someone said that it's $40. But in this day and age, $40 a day, you cannot live on that. You cannot eat property on that. You cannot clothe your family on that. So these are the things I'm saying. We have a constitutional crisis, and this thing about you having 90 days, that is abhorrent. It is abhorrent, and it's something that should be resisted by all the people of this country, and it should be rectified as soon as possible.
But you would realize that that existed, that was in place for quite some time. It's just that this is the first time it has been invoked, that's all.
Applicability of the law. Now, look, laws are made by men, and men are not infallible. So the intention of the law I will put forward was not that we should be able, in the first instance, when the term of the House is for 5 years, pardon, 5 years. So therefore, you have to have your first sitting within the first 6 months. So therefore, you can tack on another almost six months onto your term at the beginning, and then you can tack on another almost 90 days at the end. I do not really believe this was the intention. I think that is the denial of people's human rights. And that is the point I want to put on the table here.
All right, sir. All right, thank you very much for your contribution. We try to get one more call in before the 12:30 news. Good afternoon,
Mr. Price.
Yes, good afternoon. You're on the air. Go right ahead, sir.
Yeah, I want to say a very special good morning. I've listened the entire morning. Before I proceed, I have listened this morning, and I want to be in agreement with most of the things that Francis Chandler said. I think when we look at the problems facing this country, it's like having a Ferrari engine in a Mini Cooper. Or you travel to the point where there have to be some adjustment. Let me say what I mean. Most of them have spoken this morning in relation to what they would call council government or local government. Mr. Lowe spoke of it, but he spoke at a different level. I believe the time has come for Barbadians to realize that productivity and at least some increments are important for the further development of Barbados. And that says that the increments are not as much as they should be, and the productivity is really something that we have to look at. Why are you saying this? You're saying this because, similar to what was said a little while ago as far as the workers were concerned, compared with the cost of living, there's a far, far difference there. No, get to the point, Mark. The point I'm saying is that if you introduce a local government, you remove the powers from the central government in a certain way. You reduce all the ministers that are beneficiaries of most of the things that have happened. And you decide to find the way it is that you've got local government. Now, local government can be centered in five wards across the country, comprising at least about five members per ward. But they must be elected, not selected. It means that the maintenance of the five wards in the south, in the west, in the north, that these wards would be taken care of on a budget provided by central government. And that what we are facing now in terms of bad roads, and you and I would know that years ago bad roads was a thing of the past, are the maintenance of certain government buildings that are now becoming what sick buildings were taken care of. So let's look at a future Barbados and say, well, look, let's remove the concept of the Senate. The Senate endorsed what is said in the lower house. And as a result of that, it means that very few items are referred. Very few items are referred. But you have this situation that if you have a local government, the local government comes from the gut of the people within those wards. Mm-hmm. So my suggestion for the future Barbados is that let's look at local government with an elected process.
But wouldn't that be expanding the bureaucracy at a time we're trying to have smaller government?